I'd like to begin this session today with kind of a wrap-up of yesterday. One of the things that happened that you noticed was that there is not unanimity within the Black community. And that's okay. We think differently, we see things differently. And one of the things that we also noticed is the fact that white women in here did not participate particularly in the discussion. And this is for you too. And we'd like for you to come on out and join in and participate because it's for all of us. The other dimension that I think may have occurred inadvertently was the men felt that they were not allowed to speak. Now, I feel that part of the learning process is dialogue. And until we start dialoguing, not just as Black women and white women and Hispanic women and Asian women and Native American women, but as men and women, we will stay kind of where we are and not learn too much. So I also say that to say, men, this does not exclude you. You are welcome to participate and invited to participate. And women who are paler than me are encouraged to jump on in and speak your mind. What I'd like to do is to begin where we left off and get your reflections on what happened. You're not just observers of this, you know. And that's why I want to begin there. The topic is Black female spirituality, primarily because nobody's ever discussed Black female spirituality. That's why. Not because it's an exclusive subject. So, what kind of reflections do we bring this morning from last night's session?
Did you want to recap a little, just sort of? I think there may be some people here who weren't here last night.
Okay, thank
just to
you.
To give us a framework of what we think we're talking about.
What we were, a lot happened between last night and today,
right?
What we essentially dealt with last night were the presuppositions about spirituality in general, that spirituality is a dialogue with God, a dialogue about God's revelation, and the fact is that God is revealed to different people at different times and different places with different cultures. Revelation is not necessarily the same, and the culture informs the revelation. Part of God's revelation has to also do with image. Our, not only the image we have of one another, but our self-image. We listened to the words of Sojourner Truth's speech in 1851, Ain't I a Woman? Talking about the fact that women are perceived differently. And we also watched the clip from the Whoopi Goldberg on Broadway video, which really put into perspective the whole issue about what our outside appearance is, how our outside appearance is expected to look, the externals of us, and what's acceptable, what is a standard of acceptability, what are values, and we didn't have an argument with the fact that our society has values as much as we were really calling into question whether or not those values are universal. And the fact is that there are different varieties of standards of acceptability if we are a rainbow coalition or a rainbow community or just a plain old Christian community. So that's kind of where we left it yesterday, and I was dialoguing with the other Cheryl at the very end about whether or not spirituality is tied into the outward appearance. And where we ended was saying that it really isn't tied into the outward appearance. It's more a question of what is the motivation for looking the way you look. And we started talking about how many Black people believe that to be accepted and to be successful and to have arisen or won or whatever word you want to put is to look like a white woman with darker complexion. And that's kind of where we left it, and it was a very saved by the bell almost kind of situation. And I think that recaps pretty much. Does anybody want to add anything? Men are welcome to participate.
Thank you, ma'am. Well, I related to Whoopi Goldberg too, because I remember thinking in high school that if I had long, blonde hair, I look a lot better.
Okay.
So it kind of crosses with it too.
So that may be more of a universal than we even think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think most of that is dictated by what society feels is normal. And there's no definitions of normal. Normal is an undefined word. And so society dictates what the normal is for certain people and certain races. And I think as black or white or whatever, you have to choose as an individual. I think maybe if you're black and you want to perm your hair, that doesn't necessarily mean you want to be white. That just means you don't feel like combing your hair. And I think, I think that dictates whether you're ashamed of your race or not. I just think, like, white people can do they want to be black. I mean, I think it's just something that an individual chooses to do. I don't think it's reflecting whether they think they have to be another race to succeed. I don't think it's relevant.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I think the problem is that the reason society sets up these standards for whatever is that for a lot of people who are unconscious of who they are willing to accept someone else's definition of what they ought to be. And that's where the problem lies. God made us the way we are. And there's lots of people who will tell us how to be.
Well, I was going to say, I think sometimes when I live in Minneapolis, and sometimes I go downtown Minneapolis and I look around me and everybody that I see walking around me looks like they came off of a magazine cover. And for me, I think our culture destroys community and tries to present us all kinds of options about where meaning is going to be found. So if we look fashionable, then we find meaning. Consumerism is the way to meaning. And we're not taught anything about community. And we're not taught anything about spirituality as being a center from which wholeness comes. So they're all the externals, whether it be for black women or white men or whatever. I mean, you've even got to look nice to jog now, right? You've got to have your outfit. You can't play tennis without your $70.
Yves Saint Laurent.
You know, all that kind of stuff, I think, it denies our spirituality and it does get in the way of community.
Yeah.
That's because we let society dictate to us what we must be.
Yeah.
And that whole process of clothing or makeup or whatever, we can spend our whole lives on that. I mean, every spring you have to have a new wardrobe and follow the new products. I mean, who is the society that dictates to us? The consumerism, I think, is a real challenge.
Speaking as a Christian, I have to say, in listening to the issues, I look at what solution I have found for the problem, because there's always so many different types of things to deal with. And my solution to that for me is there is in scripture, he who is in me is greater than he who is in the world. So he is within me. So whatever it is I might be doing that might be to satisfy that outside world, and a lot of times you're not even aware of, then he is working within me. That greatness that is within me is going to see me through all of that, because he's going to work with me on a day-to-day basis and make me aware of it, because there's a greatness that's to come, but that's something that you have to go towards. So that's my solution for myself. That's the word that's in my heart that sees me through, or I would have to say takes me beyond having to deal with this particular issue.
Okay. It's helpful. Anybody? There are a lot of issues tied up with this, aren't there? And trying to clarify them and get at the heart of them. How does a community say no to a society? Now, that is a major topic of discussion.
By understanding that society does not live within our house.
Okay. And I understand that as individuals we can make whatever statement, you know, being comfortable with ourselves and who God made us to be, we can make an individual statement. How do we work to build the community? So I think that's, you know, that's where I am. How do we build a community of men and women who are liberated, who are not afraid of being who God made them to be, who are able to say no to the homogeneity which is kind of dictated by the society. How do we build that? How do we pull on the ancestors? How do we take what the ancestors have taught us and build for the future? How do we do that?
I think there's a lot of affirmation that goes along with this, but one of the problems that goes on is the same problem we have in the church that society has with us, with others, with itself, and that's just this basic human uncomfortableness with difference. And one of the things that church, one way, when the first time you asked that question, I thought, how do we maintain our own thing? Some religious groups have a monolithic culture of their own, and you think of certain conservative Jewish groups. You know, they eat this way, they dress this way, they control their children to act only within these constraints, and they survive that way. And that's one way to do it.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we've been struggling with here is the fact that, and I think that old image that we have too of being on a journey is really applicable. Because I was reflecting last night on my own journey of, you know, who am I, you know, and what am I doing and why. And I'm still going through that, you know, and I'm going to still go through that. And I'm not who I am today is going to look a little different than who I'll be tomorrow. Or, you know, the memory of our future is probably very true of our own personal journeys of accepting ourselves. And instead of, you know, accept, even within the church, we reflect society's actions. If somebody's different, we say, one of us must be better and one must be worse. And instead of that saying, you're great where you are, as you are, and, you know, you may do this to your hair and that to your clothes, and, you know, I went through that. You probably won't say that, but say that's good for where you are now. And just, I think that basic human acceptance is at where we are in our individual places gives us the community and the trust level, perhaps, to move on together, even though we're moving in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the hardest things I find to do, because we all judge.
Yeah.
And when it gets in a big level, the whole, you know, beyond racism, too, beneath that is, again, a judgment of something is better and something is worse, and what I am is probably better, if you can impose that. So it all gets really complicated.
It does. It gets terribly complicated.
It's kind of interesting, the alliances that are formed. For instance, on the south side of Chicago, amongst the black congregations, you have a whole bunch of parishioners who are black, so you think that there would be a sort of total solidarity. And yet within that community, there's a great diversity of economic status. And so some of the congregations could probably relate better to some of the white suburbanite congregations just because of the similarity of economic level than to their sisters and brothers who are down the street who are in a different economic situation. So, you know, the alliances that are formed are not necessarily along racial or ethnic lines, but it could be along some other kind of lines that society has set or employed.
Okay.
And they have to be transcended, just as racial lines have to be transcended.
And then Joe Maxine was trying to say something.
Yeah, I agree with, you know, everything everybody said. No, but I was thinking a little last night about the differences between black female spirituality and white female spirituality, and how my experiences in trying to gain a spirituality, you know, I can think back to a child when I was a little girl, and I think spirituality is somehow transferred from culture to culture. How you look at God and how you find God's unchanging hand. And I don't know, my mother, I don't remember her teaching me, but the way you look at God and hold on to his unchanging hand, despite oppression, despite injustices, is different between the white and the black. And I can remember just being, I think I joined Moody Bible Choir when I was a little girl. And it was all white choir. I was the only little black thing. I was in there singing. And big difference came when they asked me to buy sell these $5 tickets to my friends, $5 tickets. I don't have anybody that can afford a $5 ticket. So I noticed there was a difference there, but my spirituality was such that that can make a difference. I knew God loved me, mm-hmm. and that made somehow $5 was really significant because my Girl Scout leader was the only person that could buy my ticket. Mm-hmm. And my mother, I remember my mother when I was little, going to be a practical nurse. She was studying, and she graduated with honors, and she could not get a job. But her spirituality remained firm and the same. And I think somehow those type experiences, you know, didn't make us falter at all. And we'll get them, and they're on and on. But somehow I still know that God loves me, and his hand or her hand is holding me ever close. Yeah. And I'm going to get those experiences, and I'll cry through them and all. But so that's the way I'm viewing spirituality, and I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that's the way I'm viewing.
I don't think there is a right or wrong about spirituality.
Female spirituality.
I appreciate that. Joan wanted to say something.
Kind of coming back to the community idea, I think we live in a society that teaches us that community is based on what we have in common. And I think in the church, specifically 1 Corinthians chapter 12, that specifically in the church, the community is based upon differences. It is not an option for us to accept differences in other people. In fact, it can only be the church. We are less than the church whenever we exclude the differences.
I would like to know what some things, some pointers about what you feel is Black spirituality. I have a feeling if you live a Christ-centered life, which I'm hearing from her, and then you say spirituality is how you relate to God, I don't see where the difference is in how we relate to God then.
I think that there is a quantitative difference in our histories that informs our present. The past informs the present and will inform the future. But if we don't deal with the historical legacy, we have cut ourselves off from any history. And then we're kind of like, we have no foundation. We get confused. We become confused as a people without understanding and learning from the history. Exactly. It's not what I was thinking. I was thinking of people without a vision. It's a future. But it's very difficult to function in life without a past. It's like an amnesiac. The best way of describing it is an amnesiac. An amnesiac is paranoid, is confused, is uncertain, is almost a sick person because they don't know anything about themselves. And it's the same way if you do not understand and appreciate the fact that you are on a continuum with some stuff that happened 2,000 years ago. You are on that line. And you may choose not to acknowledge that, but that doesn't mean that you're not on that line. Part of that history.
I was just thinking of Black women I have read about, you mm-hmm. know, who were committed Christians. And I thought my thinking isn't any different than her thinking. But where she came from, I suppose I didn't understand.
Okay, Joanna?
It seems to me if we are ever going to be a community that we do have to, each of us, understand our past in order to influence our present and to mold our future. And I don't understand the spirituality of the Black woman. I understand the Black woman athlete. And maybe I can use that as an example of our need to understand one another more thoroughly and intimately. I played tennis with, my partner was a Black athlete in the 50s. We then wanted to be on a swimming team, and Annie would not go swimming with me, would not be any part of swimming. I later said it was because they can't float, those Blacks. The fact was, when I began to train Black athletes, in track. It was their hair that influenced. Because to fix black hair the way blacks would like to fix it is quite different than I get a perm and I go and I'm ready with my hair. But blacks must work long hours in relation to their hair. And so the black athlete that didn't want to swim was because she didn't like what happened to her hair by virtue of the white society saying what ought to happen to her hair. At the same time, I have a black godchild who does swim, doesn't care about her hair, but what I had to learn was how to comb that hair without pulling her hair out.
Mm-hmm.
And unless there is that intimacy of understanding, I'll never and would never have made a black athlete into a swimmer or even into track or a basketball player, because it takes an hour and a half to get to what they would like to get to in relation to their world. And if I've also approached black male athletes to have them become a member of Maryland's team, in the white community, you ask the father and convince him to go to school. In the black community, we mostly asked and talked to the mothers. And so unless we understand that heritage and then transfer that to a religious community, I think that we can never really be on the intimate Christian basis with one another. And that I think that the whites have told you everything that you need to know to be a white Christian. But
very
that
true.
We haven't listened or understood, in order to influence the present and mold the future, the blacks. And that's one of the reasons for the black experience here. But I wonder how many of us have sat down with each one of you to learn, really, the spirituality. I think there is a special spirituality that your mothers gave you that your fathers did not, that pulled you through slavery, that pulled you through all kinds of harassment that you have had, and that you have been able to survive. That white, poor, economically poor mothers haven't done, even if they had religion. And so that there's something in your spirituality that we need. And by you grabbing and helping yourselves understand the past in your spirituality, that is going to help all of us in our spirituality. That's why I think it's really important. Sorry for the sermon.
You want to say something?
Well, mine was, I guess it was also recognizing, though, that too, I really believe that there's a difference, and just trying to understand the difference, and as I observe it, I just feel real strongly about the difference, and I myself want to try to learn more of it. And it seems to me that it's a real sense of the spirit of God, more so, and a real sense of the liveliness of God's presence. And I mean, whenever I pray or I have the opportunity to go to any black churches where they're singing, gospel singing, I just love it, and it fills me. And even Therese, many times when she's, you know, conducting the choir, I can feel the spirit working in her. And as I'm thinking about it, partially, I almost wonder, I don't have enough history to know, but I almost wonder if it's because in the Caucasian tradition, the whites, we have, I don't remember who it was that started the dualistic idea of body and soul being separated, but I think among us in the white tradition, there's the real pull that body and spirit, you know, always fight, and that the flesh and the soul are enemies to one another. And that we've separated that. Where I think with the blacks, I know when I lived in Africa and I really, you know, saw that, it's like they don't have that dualistic, you know, idea. For them, it's that God created all the aspects, and they can get into their body they can get into worship with their body, and they can pray in their dance, and the spirit world is connected to the physical world, and there's just a lot of connections, which it almost seems to me like we in the white traditions through Europe and even now in America, we continue to separate those out, either for not understanding how to blend them or for a fear that the flesh will always dominate the spirit in some kind of a way that we feel is wrong. I don't know if it's from the Puritan influence or what, but it seems like that has an effect.
It is. I want to read a poem which addresses some of the things that have been mentioned in the past few minutes. It's Maya Angelou, and I'm sure you've heard the poem before. It's called "And Still I Rise." And this may help put some of these concerns and questions into perspective. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns with the certainty of tides. Just like hopes springing high. Still, I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes. Shoulders falling down like teardrops weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness upset you? Don't you take it awful hard, 'cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kiss me, kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain I rise. I'm a black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise. Maya Angelou has shared an awful lot of her own pain as we read through her works. The other author that I wanted to share with you is this Alice Walker, but it's the book In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. The whole section on In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, which is that long, about 12 pages or so, discusses black female spirituality. That's what In Search of Our Mother's Garden is all about. And I'm going to read excerpts from that to us. I'm not going to read the whole thing because that would take forever. But still, I think that it's important to hear what a black woman has written about black female spirituality, how it developed, why it's important, and how it's manifested. When the poet Jean Toomer walked through the South in the early 20s, he discovered a curious thing. Black women whose spirituality was so intense, so deep, so unconscious, that they were themselves unaware of the richness they held. They stumbled blindly through their lives, creatures so abused and mutilated in body, so dimmed and confused by pain, that they considered themselves unworthy even of hope. In the selfless abstractions their bodies became to the men who used them, they became more than sexual objects, more even than mere women. They became saints. Instead of being perceived as whole persons, their bodies became shrines. What they thought to be their minds became temples suitable for worship. These crazy saints stared out at the world wildly like lunatics or quietly like suicides. And the God that was in their gaze was as mute as a great stone. Who were these saints? These crazy, loony, pitiful women. Some of them, without a doubt, were our mothers and our grandmothers. They forced their minds to desert their bodies, and their striving spirits sought to rise like frail whirlwinds from the hard red clay. And when those frail whirlwinds fell in scattered particles upon the ground, no one mourned. Instead, men lit candles to celebrate the emptiness that remained, as people do who enter a beautiful but vacant space to resurrect a god. For these grandmothers and mothers of ours were not saints, but artists, driven to a numb and bleeding madness by the springs of creativity in them for which there was no release. They were creators who lived lives of spiritual waste because they were so rich in spirituality, which is the basis of art, that the strain of enduring their unused and unwanted talent drove them insane. Throwing away the spirituality was their pathetic attempt to lighten the soul to await their work-worn, sexually abused body could bear. How was the creativity of black women kept alive year after year and century after century, when for most of the years black people had been in America, it was a punishable crime for a black person to read or write? And the freedom to paint, to sculpt, to expand the mind with action did not exist. Consider, if you can bear to imagine it, what might have been the result if singing too had been forbidden by law. Listen to the voices of Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, Nina Simone, Roberta Flack, and Aretha Franklin, among others, and imagine those voices muzzled for life. Then you may begin to comprehend the lives of our crazy, sainted mothers and grandmothers. But this is not the end of the story, for all the young women, our mothers and grandmothers, and ourselves have not perished in the wilderness. And if we ask ourselves why and search and find the know beyond all efforts to erase it from our minds just exactly who and of what we black American women are made. Black women are called in the folklore that so aptly identifies one's status in society the mule of the world, because we have been handed the burdens that everyone else refused to carry. We have been called matriarchs, superwomen, and mean and evil bitches, not to mention castrators and Sapphire's mama. When we have pleaded for understanding, our character has been distorted. When we have asked for simple caring, we have been handed empty, inspirational appellations that then stuck in the farthest corner. When we have asked for love, we have been given children. In short, even our plainer gifts, our labors of fidelity and love, have been knocked down our throats. To be an artist and a black woman, even today, lowers our status in many respects rather than raises it, and yet, artists we will be. Therefore, we must fearfully pull out of ourselves and look at and identify with our lives the living creativity some of our great-grandmothers were not allowed to know. I stress some of them, because it is well known that the majority of our great-grandmothers knew, without even knowing it, the reality of their spirituality, even if they didn't recognize it beyond what happened in the singing at church, and they never had any intention of giving it up. In the late 20s, my mother ran away from home to marry my father. Marriage, if not running away, was expected of 17-year-old girls. By the time she was 20, she had 2 children and was pregnant with a third. 5 children later, I was born, and this is how I came to know my mother. She seemed a large, soft, loving-eyed woman who was rarely impatient in our home. Her quick, violent temper was on view only a few times a year when she battled with the white landlord who had the misfortune to suggest to her that her children did not need to go to school. She made all the clothes we wore, even my brother's overalls. She made all the towels and sheets we used. She spent the summers canning vegetables and fruits. She spent the winter evenings making quilts enough to cover all our beds. During the working day, she labored beside, not behind, my father in the fields. Her day began before sunup and did not end until late at night. There was never a moment for her to sit down undisturbed to unravel her own private thoughts, never a time free from interruption by work or the noisy inquiries of her many children. And yet it is to my mother and all our mothers who were not famous that I went in search of the secret of what has failed that muzzled and often mutilated but vibrant creative spirit that the black woman has inherited and that pops out in wild and unlikely places to this day. And when, you will ask, did my overworked mother have time to know or care about feeding the creative spirit? The answer is so simple that many of us have spent years discovering it. We have constantly looked high when we should have looked high and low. The artist that was and is my mother showed itself to me only after many years, and this is what I finally noticed. Like Mem, a character in the Third Life of Grange Copeland, my mother adorned with flowers whatever shabby home we were forced to live in. And not just your typically scraggly country stand of zinnias either. She planted ambitious gardens, and still does, with over 50 different varieties of plants that bloom profusely from early March until late November. Before she left home for the fields, she watered her flowers, chopped up the grass, and laid out new beds. When she returned from the field, she might divide clumps of bulbs, dig a cold pit, uproot and replant roses, or prune branches from her taller bushes or trees until night came and it was too dark to see. Whatever she planted grew as if by magic, and her fame as a grower of flowers spread over three counties. Because of her creativity with her flowers, even my memories of poverty are seen through a screen of blooms. Sunflowers, petunias, roses, dahlias, forsythias, spiraea, delphiniums, verbena, and so on and on. And I remember people coming to my mother's yard to be given cuttings from her flowers. I noticed that it is only when my mother is working in her flowers that she is radiant, almost to the point of being invisible, except as creator, hand and eye. She is involved in work her soul must have, ordering the universe in the image of her personal conception of beauty. Her face, as she prepares the art that is her gift, is a legacy of respect she leaves to me. For all that illumines and cherishes life, she has handed down respect for the possibilities and the will to grasp them. For her, so hindered and intruded upon in so many ways, being an artist has still been a daily part of her life. This ability to hold on, even in very simple ways, is work Black women have done for a very long time. Guided by my heritage of a love of beauty and a respect for strength, in search of my mother's garden, I found my own. And perhaps in Africa over 200 years ago, there was just such a mother. Perhaps she painted vivid and daring decorations in oranges and yellows and greens on the walls of her hut. Perhaps she sang, a voice like Roberta Flack's, sweetly over the compounds of her village. Perhaps she wove the most stunning mats or told the most ingenious stories of all the village storytellers. Perhaps she was herself a poet, though only her daughter's name is signed to the poems we know.
Do you think that daughters of this generation have this and are giving it to their daughters?
No. And that's why it's important to talk about it. I think that this generation coming up is individualistically inclined, and they don't understand the history. I think that it's important for us to be talking about it with them so that they start understanding that there is something that they own, have owned, and as they look at God's future rushing towards them, that they are prepared, they have a handle on it, there is something that they can be proud of.
I want to say, perhaps as a whole, that this generation will not have that same thing to give. But individually, myself, I do believe that my children will have something that they will gain from me. Because what you were reading there, it makes me think of my mother. I understand what my mother passed on to me, and to say what her richness was would be, I saw my mother pray. She had no shame in praying. We were raised in the inner city. My father left when I was in the fourth grade, so it was my mother supporting six children. And there were times when she knew there was not going to be enough food, that there would not be enough money coming in to meet the needs. And she didn't say anything at that time, but we saw our mother go through this prayer, her private hour. And it wasn't until after it had passed that she would explain to us what took place before. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with that understanding that those things do pass. This was something that my mother instilled in me somehow. And like I said, you know, but yet you don't know. And at some point a parent gives that information to you. and it makes your future seem more secure.
Mm-hmm.
There is something, see, what I've been hearing here for this, the days that we've been here, I hear everyone speaking about the community. And a lot of times I don't involve myself in the conversations because there's something inside me that says, B, you are in the family. I can't deal with the community because if I don't deal with my family, if I'm not interacting with my children, those are the ones that go out into the community. These are the ones that are making up the community. So what is it that we're giving our children to become a part of this community? You can't solve community's problems if the problems are not resolved within your home. Too much does not take place within the home. There's a part of me that would like to be political, that would just like to be out there and speaking, but there is something else where I just feel myself blocked in, and it has to be within the home. My children aren't sheltered. They go out into the world, and they feel free to speak. They feel comfortable meeting new people, but there is something where they are firmly rooted in family. Children need to be grounded in, they need a foundation, and that starts with God and family. Those are the important things, but I see too much where we're trying to work on the community. But what are we doing for the family? The jobs that I've had over the past few years, I ended up quitting because in working with kids, I found out that they thought of me in a very positive manner. But I went home to my kids and I had nothing left for them. And I can only do that so much. There's a part of me that would like to give to the community, but it cannot, I can't divide myself. It cannot be to the expense of my children.
You are all they have to be a part of the past. Mm-hmm. As you prepare them for the future, you and your husband, your parents, his parents. And this society we live in would really like to take up all your energy out there. So that by the time you do get home, you are just too tired to deal with anybody, including yourself.
But is society doing that to me, or am I doing that to myself?
I think we choose to allow society to do that.
Because it's a lot easier to be out there. It would be a lot easier for me to be out there talking to someone else's child. Because I really don't have to deal with them afterwards. And I can give them something close to the answer. And then I'm gone. But with my children, this is something that I have to live with on a day-to-day basis because they don't give you a break.
I can't help but ask the question then what the institutional church is doing to support that. Because our church, you know, the little St. James Church in Seattle wants me to do this and this and this and this, and then I'm feeling exhausted again.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. We're looking for heritage.
But the church is not a living thing in that sense where it's saying, you must do this, you must do that. I don't answer to the church. I have to answer to something that's deep within myself. Because no matter which church, we belong to a non-denominational church, but no matter which church we go to, everyone has, I feel that all the different denominations, that's where man's laws come into effect. And I don't want to know about any of that. I just want to deal with the Word. The Bible is very simple. The Word is very simple. So when I go into whatever church and whatever things they may be setting up and asking of us, I still have to go back to my inner being and say what is right for the family. And that helps me to simplify this world that I live in because I've reached the point where, and we were talking about it earlier, I must simplify the things that are in this world because there's just too much and I cannot take it all in. So when I go back to that which I do have a certain amount of control over, and that is the family, the core, and to strengthen that because that makes up a part of that whole.
I think that's the breakdown of our communities. All around in America,
it's in the family.
If we had more parents feeling like you do, we wouldn't have all this problems we're having. I don't think.
The breakdown is right in the family.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And you can't fix the whole if the parts aren't working.
Ingrid?
The breakdown's in the family, in a sense, but I also
feel like the breakdown has already happened in society in some kind of way that makes it impossible for families to survive without both parents, or if there is only one parent, that parent going out to work. The institutions in society are not responsive to the needs of children. Our society doesn't value children. Mm-hmm. Our workplaces don't have flex time. They don't have shared jobs. They don't have part-time jobs with decent salaries. I mean, if a family wants to get themselves out of poverty, often both parents have to work, or often there is only one parent, and the children pay the consequences. They get the shaft, and the parents pay the consequences in anguish, but they have to bring in enough income so that the family can survive. So I really blame the institutional aspects of our society for not valuing children as our resource.
Or the family. As a whole unit.
Yeah.
But at fault, on one hand, society is at fault, and you can place you and you can point a finger at it, but you're saying that they don't value children. But children are not even valued by their parents.
Right. Yeah.
How can you expect society to value a child when you don't? And that's exactly what people, they send their kids off to be babysat at school. They don't teach them any values there in the home. Respect is not there, and then they expect the child to go to school. It doesn't work that way.
I think we're at a point of which came first. Is it the society that influences the family, or is it the family that's affecting the society? And I think that it may be a both and.
Well, if things aren't working, you can always point your finger. If things aren't working in your family, you can say society's
at fault. But B, on the other hand, you're also absolutely right. It's got to start in the family. But when you're being busted by the society in order to survive, to have both parents working, 9 to 5, it means getting up at 6, whatever, shuffling the kids off to daycare center or school for the teacher to babysit, just as you said. That works against family, because when you finally get home, if you get off work at 5, you finally get home at 6, nobody feels like cooking.
That's right.
Cheryl all day.
Yeah.
There's another thing that just occurred to me as sort of a comment, but and I don't know exactly how to frame it here, but I've been very conscious this week at Holden how much of a family place this is, and people come with their kids, and they are family units. But if I look back over my last 10 years of working in the church, I think of how many institutional churches filled the place of family for so many of the people. And I think, you know, how would this relate to their lives, you know, some of this. And I think in terms of the question of what the role of the church is comes up. And I think of some families are so far gone, there's no putting them back together. And in the churches, we have people who desperately need family. And it's not a matter of supporting the family that no longer exists for them, but how is the church also not just tangential to the structures that exist, the society structures, the family structures. But what about all this increasing number of people that are no longer fitting in either one of those? They're shut out by society, their families are destroyed, and they need all the same things that we need and that we look for, and they need that. They need a history too, which for them has been probably more negative than positive, and yet they need that connection with the positive for their own sense of spirituality. They need to know there's a future for them, even though they're not tracked through any of society's normal norms. We're getting to a future that's worth getting to.
That's right.
And so the church somehow has a role in there that doesn't fall into either one of those categories, just dealing with society or just supporting a family. It's a new thing, and they didn't teach us to do this in seminary, so that's another thing that you try to discover.
You never know what that child is going to draw on that's going
sure.
to take him. And so whatever's taking place, I see it as positive. And before I said that I quit 2 jobs because I didn't have anything to get, didn't mean that I stopped working. I still work. Both my husband, we work full-time jobs. But you have to come to that realization yourself, you know, as parents, as adults, what it is that you're lacking on your part. Working a full-time job, Taylor still will make the time to coach the children in soccer. And a lot of insurance agents, you look at their schedules and they're gone from first thing in the morning until the last thing. So it always comes back to self, what it is we're doing, what it is we're lacking, and why it is we're moving out of that area.
In terms of this, wait a minute, Hope. This lady had something to say.
I guess I hear so much all the time. It's very difficult sometimes for me to express what I like, but I hear. Things that I affirm I feel very, very strongly about the family too, and I realize exactly what she's saying, that there are other aspects of us that need the other. But I still think that that's one area that where we can start. I feel so strongly myself about the family. And there are some aspects of it that I think the no, like we mentioned in Bible class sometime, comes with no to the stylists that tell us my kids must have jeans all the time, or my kids have to have. And I understand the difficulty too with the peer pressure in the children of always having to have the same styles as everyone else. But some of those no's come along in those areas too. It isn't just society saying that we have to have all those, but in the family itself we can reinforce that, look, we don't have to have this kind of clothing all the time to say who we are, that we value, that we are of great value before God. And then that being reinforced in the family, I can see a little bit of that in my own family, because we had 10 children and we did not have the resources to keep up with styles. And I think sometimes when we talk about clothing, I think our great men that get paid big salaries are the ones that influence to a great deal what we wear, more than just our neighbor lady. But you know, every now, at least is what I see, every 2 months they bring out some new kind of thing that if you're not wearing, you're not quite
less than human.
Yes, and that needs to be reinforced in the family.
In looking at the statistics for the people of God in the New Lutheran Church, I see that they're overwhelmingly white and they're more married and all this kind of stuff. And so I think that we have to be very intentional about supporting those who don't fit the norms. And specifically, I'm thinking of single parents. I mean, if you're a single parent in some congregations, you're an oddity. Mm-hmm. And there's not a great deal of spiritual or emotional support for that status which you hold. And I just think that we have to be intentional about, you know, realizing that there's a variety of people that really need to be affirmed.
And that's what Alice Walker was talking about too, about how black women traditionally have maintained those postures and still survived.
Okay, well, since you guys are speaking from an adult point of view, I'm going to bring some of the youth point of view. As someone, you ask the generation, how do we feel that we can carry this past on? Well, so far as lacking, like if you have full-time jobs, my mother is a single parent, and she's from the older generation, so she can carry it on. But priority is what you have to do. I mean, you may be tired at 6, but if you want that done, you will ignore your tiredness and do it. I mean, that's not an excuse to say, well, we work all day, forget it, I want to rest. You may want to, but you don't always get what you want. And so at that time, you have to prioritize what you want done. And if you want this legacy passed on to your children, you will put aside your time and do it if that's what you really want. And I don't think it's going to die out, because it's the only thing that black people have that they came here with, that they will leave here with. It wasn't given to us. It was something when the Homo sapien was found in Africa. It was that he had it, he carried it on, and we came as slaves with it, and we're going to die with it. And I don't think it's going to die. It may not be out as much, but it's there.
Amen. That's the voice of you. Did you want to say something, you?
Well, I was just going to ask too if we can still maybe define the spirituality a little bit more, because I can see that family relates, and I'm trying to in my head make all these connections about how maybe even the way black women view children as different from white women, the way that they view children, maybe that has something to do with, depending on the perspective of the relationship with God. And maybe, I don't know, Maxine or even Bea, if you could speak a little bit more about the relationship with God that you all have felt intuitively or something, or observations about what you see lacking in white women, you know, or, because I notice a lot of times we're real closed about being expressive.
Let's have Maxine and Cheryl. Jack, you had your hand up?
I don't think it's lacking. I think it's just different. It's not lacking. But I was just telling you some of the components of my spirituality. I had the unique experience of working in an all-white church. I was a student of the Norwegians and me. Now, there was spirituality there, and I could feel it, you know, and I'll just try to, off the top of my head, tell you what I viewed, you know, of course they were kind of closed mouthed. They weren't like me talking about it all the time. But I did a Bible study. It wasn't even a Bible study. It was just a little talk in one of the circles, one of the little Martha circles, I'm sure you're all. And we were talking about the past and how your forefathers have come over and worked and gained access to this and access to that. And it was a light conversation, but there were about three or four women who started tearing. And so, you know, I'm not saying it's lacking anything, it's just different, you know, your spirituality. The past, I saw several books on the Swedish past, and just your forefathers, and thinking about that, and how you've come here, and how you've struggled, and how you've done this and done that, and the little red Swedish horses, and all those things are just really, really important. The routine of the service and how it goes, Those things I felt, you know, I don't know if I'm explaining myself, but I could feel a spirituality there. It's just different from mine. Mine has got other components that are very crucial and important to me. And I felt that was some of the components of my experience there, raising that point. How does that sound? Does it sound like...
Let's give Cheryl a chance to say something. She's had her hand up.
Anyway, I think I'm sitting here listening to everyone. It all sounds real great. And then you ask about the black woman's spirituality. It is different. I think if you go back to grassroots, and you don't have to go back as far as slavery. I'm 42. My mother is 65. My mother raised five children alone. You know, when you consider hard times and when you consider tearing, a lot of people think, black people think of the slave. You don't have to go back that far. I had a girlfriend who had a European background, and she thought of hard times as when her parents came here, they could not bring their china and their silver from Holland, you know, just stuff like that. And I'm thinking of dirt floors, no roof, no clothes. You know, and all you have is you and God. My mother always told me this one, and this is why I think it's so important, that we kind of throw away all those external kinds of things, and I think this is where my spirituality comes from. As my mother said, when it comes down to it, it's you and God. And that's it. You don't have anything else. It's you and God. And that's what keeps me going. And I think that's what kept me going. My mother is an educated woman. She could not find a job as a teacher. In her last year of college, she had planned to go back. She went to an all-white school. When she went to start a class, they told her they had reached their quota. She could not attend class. There was another black student whose family had money, and they put that particular black person in her spot, so she could not finish her school. And that was at Rutgers University in Indiana. So my mother ended up in the post office. There were a lot of educated people her age who ended up working for the government because they could not get jobs. Could not get jobs. And she's had good times and bad times and rough times and, you know, easy times. But the one thing she always told me, she says, no matter what anybody says or says they will do or what you have, when it comes down to it, it's you and God. And then when I was about 15 or 20, I heard Bill Cosby doing one of his things, and he says, yeah, you and me, Lord, and I always think about that. And I think that's basically where black women's spirituality comes from. They don't, you know, all the external kinds of things, they're fine. But when it comes down to it, that's the way I feel. You know, I have me to depend on, and God, and that's it.
And it is being passed on, you know.
It is.
It really is. I heard somebody say, but... Oh, I was just so elated. Just one little thing. Hey.